I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I am Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My first guest, Dr. Mark Moyad, occupies an endowed position created and funded entirely by the patients he has helped over the past 15 years. He is the Jenkins Poe Kempner Director of Complementary and Alternative Medicine at the University of Michigan Medical Center, Department of Urology. Mark has an extensive biography that is published on the Holistic Health Show website, and only the highlights will be presented here. He received his Master's in Public Health degree from the University of South Florida with a focus on epidemiology and dietary supplement research, and he received his medical education and degree from the Wayne State University School of Medicine. He is the primary author of over 130 published medical journal articles and is the former editor-in-chief of the medical journal Seminars in Preventive and Alternative Medicine by Elsevier. He is or has been an editor and reviewer for multiple diverse medical journals in urology, oncology, and alternative medicine, and recently accepted an appointment on the editorial board for the medical journal Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine. Mark has also maintained a consultant practice in complementary and alternative medicine for the past 15 years and has lectured on breast, prostate, and a variety of other cancers, in addition to cardiovascular disease and general health promotion internationally in almost every country and in all 50 states and at every single major academic institution. He has and continues to consult for and appears regularly in major magazines and television shows devoted to health in the United States, and is currently being featured regularly on the Huffington Post, Fox News in Chicago, appeared on the Dr. Oz Show in the fall of 2011, and was featured in the March 2012 issue of Fitness Magazine. Mark is the co-author or author of 9 books, including his most recent, Dr. Moyad's No Bogus Science Health Advice, a step-by-step guide to what works and what is worthless, Beyond Hormone Therapy, a guide for advanced prostate cancer patients, and his most recent, The Dr. Moyad Guide to Male Sexual Health in June 2012. Mark also recently agreed to and is completing the guidebook on complementary and alternative medicine in urology for a 2012-2013 release date from Springer Medical Publishing Company in New York. Mark has probably educated the largest number of healthcare professionals on the topic of complementary and alternative medicine and dietary supplements in the world, while also regularly writing and publishing the largest number of medical articles on integrative medicine. And in 2009, he was named as one of the most influential doctors in the United States by USA Today. For the past 15 years, Dr. Moyad has also volunteered weekly for national and local patient advocacy groups and low-income free clinics in need of help, and currently volunteers for multiple national patient advocacy groups to provide monthly education, better access to the latest medical care, and other resources. He also helped for years after Hurricane Katrina and worked with the Lower Ninth Ward Health Clinic in New Orleans to provide anything and everything from books for children in the waiting room, medical supplies, and regular fundraising for the clinic itself. Currently, he is helping to improve medical services in Haiti and assisting with bringing kids to the United States in need of more serious medical treatment. In 2013, Dr. Moyad will become part of the Promoting Wellness Foundation, whose primary purpose is to improve access and the health and well-being of indigent patients around the world. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Dr. Mark, and I look forward to hearing about how our immune system influences our health and illnesses. Now, first, why has there been an increase in immune-related diseases such as allergies and asthma?
Wow, I don't know if we have about 50 minutes here to talk about it? Well, there's a lot of reasons, and I'll tell you which one I sort of lean toward. I mean, first of all, if you look at, I always remind people how fortunate we are, in a sense, that if you were born in 1900, the average life expectancy was about 46 years for a man, for example, and that's kind of strange for me because I just had my 47th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, past 2000, people are living long lives. But one of the things is people are living longer, and there's a higher chance for an increased awareness for what's going on and increased number of diagnoses. And so that's part of it, but that doesn't explain really this, what we would consider an explosion in immune-related diseases and allergies and asthma. One of the theories that I actually subscribe to very much is this one called the hygiene hypothesis. And this idea is, as we become a more developed society, one of the catches is that we've tried to sterilize everything.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want our kids to get sick. We don't want them to necessarily get a cold or some other type of infection. And the truth is, by throwing in antibacterial soaps, by the overuse of antibiotics, trying to sterilize all of our environment doesn't allow our immune system to basically become mature or competent. So there is a lot of momentum behind what's called the hygiene hypothesis, which is we're not letting our kids, we're not letting this generation, we're not allowing them to become ill. We want them to be free and clear of any sort of bug out there,
mm-hmm.
and that has cost us.
Mm-hmm.
It has cost us because when we do get exposed to something that would otherwise be minimal, we have an exacerbated or a very strong immune reaction. And the interesting thing is a lot of research has been done lately in the area of asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's been studies in Europe looking at kids who grew up on farms that were exposed to animals or in daycare or someone that has a number of brothers and sisters. You know, I had two brothers, and I felt like we were getting sick all the time as kids.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that, you know, life has changed. We don't have those same kind of exposures anymore. Fewer people in the family unit, very protected environments in terms of immune, and we've suffered from that. And the hygiene hypothesis really has a lot of research now. If you look at some third world countries where people get ill a lot when they're younger, some of these individuals who live to be just as old as we are don't have these higher rates of asthma and allergies. So one of my favorite explanations of what's going on there with these high rates of allergies and asthma is this hygiene hypothesis that we've got to be careful about what we do and don't want to expose our kids to.
Mm-hmm. Then how does our lifestyle affect our immune system?
Well, the interesting thing is I always try to, it sounds so simplistic, but I always try to say that basically the immune system is so intimately tied into everything else we do,
mm-hmm.
including lifestyle, that you've got to, all the recommendations you're getting on lifestyle in terms of being heart healthier might reduce your risk of certain cancers. All these things that are controllable in our lifestyle actually affect the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll say, for example, that heart healthy is immune healthy. And what that essentially means is we kind of separate the different systems of the body, as in they're affected by different things. That's not true. All the things that you hear about that can affect your heart health, for example, and all these things that are hammered into our heads of what can affect our overall health, that also affects our immune system. And it could be anything from A to Z that you could imagine. So, for example, someone drinks a little bit too much, that's immune suppressive. That can reduce their immune system.
Mm-hmm.
So if you drink beyond moderation or drink at all, you have to be careful because that can affect your immune system in a bad way. If you look at blood pressure, cholesterol,
mm-hmm.
too high blood pressure, cholesterol affects your immune system in a bad way. Dental disease, your overall diet. I mean, everything that you hear that you have control over in your life, and you can make more healthy. It just doesn't affect all these other, it doesn't affect your hormones and your heart. It absolutely impacts your immune system. Mm-hmm. That's why we believe, for example, smokers have higher rates of infections. One of the reasons you want to quit smoking is not only because lung cancer is so deadly, it has such a detrimental impact on your overall immune health. Mm-hmm. When we talk about stress and how stress can age you, what we should also say is that stress has a significant and enormously negative impact on your immune system. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you one that gets associated with every other condition but your immune health, and this is what we're learning lately. If you want to know how intimately tied your immune system is into what you're willing to do in your lifestyle. We say there's an obesity epidemic in the United States, and that's absolutely true. We do have an obesity epidemic, and people will tell you about diabetes, and they'll tell you about blood pressure, and they'll tell you about cholesterol changes, and they'll tell you about all these things that happen. But the truth of the matter is what we've learned, for example, about weight gain is we used to think just 5-10 years ago that fatty tissue or adipose tissue, well, that kind of sat there and didn't do anything in your body. In fact, it was dormant tissue. What we've now realized is it's a very active tissue. It's a hormone-secreting tissue. And what it creates is a sense of or a recognition by the rest of the body that basically it's similar to what I would consider an autoimmune disease. In other words, it really causes your immune system to spend a lot of time and be in overdrive in certain areas of the body. So it really kind of tricks and throws off your immune system. So one of the worst things for your immune system is actually weight gain. So it's interesting because a lot of people don't tie in the thought of lifestyle impacting your immune health, but everything that you could possibly name that goes on in terms of your lifestyle has some impact on your immune system, and I think that's absolutely fascinating and also absolutely scary.
Right. if the immune system then plays a role in cardiovascular disease, what can people do to prevent it?
You know, the most simplistic recommendation you can give a patient or an individual, and they'll look at you and say, wait a second, what are you talking about? You can tell almost anybody that you see, I want you to follow one thing in your life, and that is to take your cardiovascular risk to as close to zero as possible. And people will say, well, okay, well, that's not easy, and why cardiovascular disease? And, well, it's been the number one killer of Americans now. It's about almost 100 years running. I mean, it's been going on that long. It's been the number one killer. And what we've thought for a long time is that it's simply a situation where you have these arteries, and they're like pipes, and when they become plugged, the heart muscle doesn't get enough oxygen, and someone can be in big trouble or they can die. So we thought over the past several decades that cardiovascular disease was about clogged arteries, and it's partially about clogged arteries. But when more and more research was done, whether it was Cleveland Clinic or another very famous academic institution, we began to realize that this new age of cardiovascular disease, when we're seeing cardiac problems and even death at earlier ages in men and women, it's not necessarily caused by clogging of the pipes. That's a percentage of these situations that happen. But a large number of them are by very small plaques, we call them, that don't take up much space in the arteries, and then they suddenly become unstable and they break, and then there's a big clotting reaction that occurs. In other words, the pipe is barely blocked. In fact, it's not blocked at all, and then something awful happens. Well, how does this happen? How can something so small be so damaging? And that's where we really began to figure out that inflammation or your immune system plays a large role in your cardiovascular health. And essentially, all these things that we mentioned before, when we were talking about cholesterol, blood pressure, the amount of exercise you do, your blood sugar level, whether or not you're exposed to tobacco, weight gain, all of these things not only impact your heart health, but they also dramatically impact your immune health. And if you aren't following all these recommendations, or most of these recommendations on how to keep your cardiovascular disease risk low, what we're finding is it can cause changes in the immune system where the immune system can actually work against you to create an unstable situation that can increase your risk of cardiac disease. So I'm finding it interesting now that a lot of the new markers or a lot of the new blood tests that we're studying right now to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, they're really immune system markers. So there's been a lot of discussion of one called HSCRP. It was a Harvard study that looked at when you can lower levels of this C-reactive protein, this marker of inflammation, this marker that we use in the immune system, when you can lower it, it seems to reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease. But the immune system, we're realizing, is very much tied into. It's very much a strong marriage going on with that and cardiovascular health. Mm-hmm. And I find it interesting that anything that throws off your immune system basically can throw off your heart health and make you heart unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you my favorite study of 2012. I don't think anything will surpass it. There was a large government study done. It was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Now, I'm not giving this study to, not to depress you, but to impress you how much work we need to do, for example, in the United States. They decided to look across the United States over a long length of time into seven parameters. They wanted to look at people of all different ages, all different races, and they wanted to see seven basic things. Who had a normal blood pressure? Who had a normal cholesterol? Who just followed a moderately healthy, natural, or plant-based diet? Who exercised on average about 30 minutes a day? Who had a normal blood sugar? Who stayed away from tobacco? And who was of normal weight? So let me repeat those seven, because when you hear them, they're not so overwhelming, but when you put them all together, they become a little bit overwhelming for a lot of listeners. They wanted to know who had a normal blood pressure, normal cholesterol, a moderate diet, exercised daily, had a normal blood sugar, stayed away from tobacco, and basically carried a normal weight. And when they did the calculations over several decades, and again, this was published 2012 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, they found out that 1 to 2% of Americans across the United States were basically keeping those numbers normal or doing those things on a regular basis. 98 to 99% of Americans were not. Now, where is that commercial on television? You're never going to see that. But just think of those seven basic cardiovascular risk factors. All of those are tied into immune health. We have the secret to longevity, but only 1 to 2% of us are either being told about it or are following it. I find that absolutely incredible.
Right, right. And is this the same type of statistics you would get for other conditions, such as cancer?
Well, these are others. Yeah, you know, it's funny. We make this so complicated, and I think part of, when I say we in the medical system, I think we're all guilty of it. This is also what we see in the other areas. When people are following all these behaviors that are immune healthy or heart healthy, are seeing a striking reduction in certain types of cancers in those same individuals. You know, when I went through public health and I went through medical school, I was, you know, you're almost taught that these different diets, you know, there's this there's this heart diet, there's this one that reduces colon health, colon cancer, there's this one that reduces prostate cancer, and they're all intimately tied into the same system. So the answer is overwhelmingly yes, that by following those seven changes or becoming heart healthy or immune healthy, it seems to play a large protective role against certain types of cancers.
Are there supplements that you recommend that people take to prevent illnesses or to strengthen their immune system?
Well, I mean, there's a few I talk to people about. I like to, and I hate to sound like a broken record, but I like to go back to the fact, is this person doing everything possible in their lifestyle to protect themselves? Because I want them first, I want them not to think as pills is the answer, regardless of where they come from. First, I want to think that they're the answer in self-empowerment. So can we do something, can we work on something in their lifestyle that can make them healthier? And the answer 99% of the time is absolutely. Now, there are people in this world that they can do everything right and still something bad can happen. And they may need protection in terms of immune health. And, you know, immune health is an interesting category in supplements. So I'll tell you, we worked in a couple of studies of this product called Epicor. It's basically a fermented yeast-based product. And that went through three clinical trials. All of them have been published with over 300 individuals, randomized, double-blind placebo, looking at just general immune health to prevent cold and flu-like symptoms, and another one to prevent allergy-based symptoms. And all three of those studies were essentially positive in favor of taking this supplement daily. I don't work with the company anymore right now. I help them in basically with their studies. But I have to give them a lot of credit. They received, and I was proud of it, the company that makes it, called Embrya, they received one of the highest distinctions in terms of just research in the supplement category. So that's one supplement that seems to provide, for people that are concerned in the area of allergies and during cold and flu season, that's a supplement that seems to make sense, the Epicor supplement. Another couple supplements that we're looking at and studying, and one of my old favorites, believe it or not, I know this one's going to sound boring, but I was involved a while ago in publishing a couple of these papers, is I still am a big fan of vitamin C on some level. And the reason I am is that people fight all day long about what prevents colds or not, but vitamin C has had an incredibly safe track record at very low dosages and even in some studies at high dosages. And I find it interesting that the concentration of vitamin C in immune cells tends to be anywhere from 30 to 50 times higher than what you see in the bloodstream. In other words, immune cells depend on a very large amount. And if you look at analyses, it's not just about preventing colds, but it's about preventing serious infections that can actually be deadly. This, you know, one example is pneumonia. So what I like about vitamin C, just like what I like about Epicor, is it's had a very good safety record, essentially, and that's important. The dosage you have to take is not that large. You know, most of the data runs in 250, 500 milligrams. So vitamin C, I find it as another fascinating one. So, and that's had enough of clinical trials to get me excited. A newer one out there that we're looking at that's just starting to pick up is blue-green algae or spirulina. It's a derivative. That's going through some clinical studies right now. Another one that's going through clinical studies that we're watching carefully, and has been around a long time, actually, is American ginseng. A lot of different trials in the pediatric population that it might be important for immune health. But I always ask myself this, has it had enough studies? Has it gone through enough clinical trials? Does it seem to be as safe as a sugar pill? And in the ones that I mentioned, the answer seems to be overwhelmingly yes, and they seem to do something for you. So I do believe there's several supplements for people that are concerned about their immune health they can take, along with some of the lifestyle changes we talked about today.
Great. Now, Mark, would you tell us about your books, products, and services, and how the listeners can reach you?
Well, that's very nice of you. I get to do a a little advertisement for myself, which I don't mind. Most of the books that I've done 9 books now. You can find them anywhere, most bookstores. You can find them on Amazon. You can go to Spry Publishing, which is my newest publisher, S-P-R-Y Publishing. They have my newsletter there. If you just type in Google, Spry Publishing, it will show you a diet book I wrote, some other types of books that we wrote, a couple newsletters. They can go there. They can simply just type my name, and you can see articles that are get posted on anywhere from different magazines to different email newsletters. So I probably the best place to go to see what I'm doing is at the Spry Publishing site, S-P-R-Y Publishing. That will come up right away, and Dr. Mark Moyad. It will show you any studies we're doing, any of the supplements that we're excited about, what we're doing in the area of cancer right now, and it's probably the easiest. If worse comes to worse, though, you can always type in Amazon and take a look at some of the things that I've written and see if you get excited about it. But I certainly love this area of holistic health. I love the area of natural medicine. And those are just some quick ways to find out what I'm doing.
Great. Well, I appreciate this very much, Mark. It's been very interesting. It's new content for me, and I'm sure for the listeners. And I look forward to talking with you again when I do the cancer series next.
So me too. I really appreciate being on this show. I think it's outstanding, and I appreciate the time just to cover these things that not a lot of people get to hear about.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I invite you to join me in reading the new fall issue of A Distinctive Style magazine at www.adistinctivestyle.com. This issue, like the fall issue last year, focuses on inspirational cancer stories. Several children with leukemia were included, and one I especially liked was Christopher, age 9, who was described by his friends as the type of friend everyone would want. smart, loyal, brave, funny, and always a good sport. He was diagnosed with leukemia at age 3 and had a recurrence at age 8. Unfortunately, Christopher died. It is always a pleasure for me to read about Fran Dressler and Sharon Winters, who were also included in last year's fall issue. Fran has been cancer-free for 11 years and wrote Cancer Smancer about her survival. She also started the Cancer Smancer movement and foundation that emphasizes preventing cancer. Sharon Winters, another long-term cancer survivor, talked about the influence of the environment on cancer development and how to prevent it using information from her book, co-authored with Burton Goldberg, titled Survival, A Family Guide for Thriving in a Toxic World. For me, this book was the most comprehensive guide currently available. I was also interviewed for this issue, and you will find more about my story that is being published in a book on surviving lung cancer that will be available for purchase next year. Beyond the many interesting stories of cancer survivors and sufferers, I was interested in information on Farmageddon, about the war on American family farms, and another on local food movements, both which resonated with me. Also of interest was the interview with Peter Shankman, who is the founder of HARO, Help a Reporter Out, the world's largest free source repertory. If you are looking for speakers, guests, for radio shows, conference, or whatever, or if interested in being considered as a speaker guest, this is the place to be. I have used the service and am very pleased with the results obtained. And last, a mention of the music of 2-time Grammy Award winner Jimmy Warnes. You will not want to miss these and other stories in the fall issue of A Distinctive Style magazine, available at www.adistinctivestyle.com. My second guest, Dr. Thomas O'Brien, is an internationally recognized speaker and workshop leader specializing in gluten sensitivity and celiac disease. He is a Sherlock Holmes for chronic disease and metabolic disorders and is a clinician par excellence in treating these conditions from a functional medicine perspective. He holds teaching faculty positions with the Institute for Functional Medicine and the National University of Life Sciences. His passion is teaching the many manifestations of gluten sensitivity and celiac disease as they occur inside and outside the intestines. He says in sensitive individuals, gluten sensitivity can trigger autoimmune disorders, epilepsy, thyroid disease, diabetes, migraines, chronic fatigue syndrome, and more. Perhaps one of the more surprising messages is the impact of gluten sensitivity on the brain. The dimmer switch that occurs in the brain, especially in children, is one that parents and caregivers would never suspect. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Dr. O'Brien, and I look forward to hearing about celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. Is there really a problem with wheat in our diet today, or is this another fad?
Well, that's a really good question. And one would think, because now there are movie stars and who are going on the diet and Olympians who are testifying that it helped them to win their medals and things, one wonders, is this just another fad? And actually, it's not. And all of the projections by scientists are that it's going to continue to be recognized as more and more of a problem. And the reason for that is that the wheat that is on the market today is completely indigestible by the human digestive tract. That in the last 50 years, the wheat has been hybridized so many times for commercial purposes that there's something called the 50-50 rule. In the last 50 years, the gluten content of wheat has gone up by over 50%. Gluten is a protein in wheat, and the word gluten means glue. So the more of this gluey, sticky protein that you have in the wheat, the flour stretches more, so it makes better baked goods. They taste better. They're lighter. You can stretch them out, and they hold their shape. But the human digestive system can't break it down, and it causes inflammation in the digestive system, in the digestive tract, and that causes something called intestinal permeability. Also, the slang term is called leaky gut. And then you get inflammation throughout your body, and the symptoms are as varied as there are systems of the body.
And is there a difference between gluten sensitivity and celiac disease?
There is. Celiac disease is when you have a gluten sensitivity that's affecting your intestines. The intestines are a tube, 20, 25 feet long, winds around inside your abdomen. The inside of the tube is lined with shag carpeting. The shags are called microvilli, and the shags are where we absorb our vitamins and minerals. This shag over here is where calcium's absorbed. This shag over here, magnesium. These shags, proteins. These shags, the good fats. All the shags absorb different nutrients. Celiac disease is when you have a gluten sensitivity affecting the tissue of the intestines, the microvilli, the shags, and your shags wear down, and you get Berber. And if you've got Berber, you don't absorb calcium. And if you don't absorb calcium, you get osteoporosis. That's why in the Archives of Internal Medicine in 2006, they published a paper that said every osteoporotic patient needs to be checked for celiac disease, as celiac disease could be the cause of their osteoporosis. So I show that study to our doctors, and I say, so doctors, if the Archives of Internal Medicine say every osteoporotic patient needs to be checked for celiac disease, which one are you not going to check? And it just gets our doctors thinking, my goodness, I think I better take a look at this. So that's celiac disease. It's when it affects the intestines and the microvilli of the intestines. But if you have a gluten sensitivity affecting the brain, it may be attention deficit or epilepsy. Or there are papers in the medical literature of reversing the diagnosis of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, reversing. And these patients come back to normal without any symptoms. The symptoms go away, and the lesions in the brain, called white matter lesions in the brain, disappear on a gluten-free diet. Now, that's not all ALS patients, obviously, but there are three studies in my full-day presentation to doctors of reversing ALS and getting rid of the lesions in the brain just by getting gluten out of their diets. So that's if it affects the brain. If it affects the muscles, it can cause, the technical term is sporadic inclusion body myositis. Now, that's a big Scrabble word, but that is the most common cause of muscle pain in people over 50, is when you have inflammation in your muscles, and it's sporadic. It's in some muscles, not others. Some muscles hurt, some don't. And the most common cause of that, 100% of these patients in one study, in other studies it's 85%, 90% of these patients with sporadic inclusion body myositis have gluten sensitivity. And when you take gluten out of the diet, the muscle pain goes away. So it can be your brain, it can be your muscles, it can be your kidneys, it can be your liver, it can be your intestines. Celiac disease is where we learned about all of this in the last 50 years. So the primary manifestation that's been so well recognized is in the intestines if you have a gluten sensitivity. But we now know for every one person that has intestinal problems, there are eight that don't. They have problems in some other part of their body. So celiac disease is not the most prominent, but it's the most well-known because there's over 19,000 research articles published on this in the medical literature.
And does the gluten sensitivity affect children also?
Oh, my goodness. Here's a study in the Journal of Attention Disorders in 2006. They took 132 children who had this gluten sensitivity, and they put them on a gluten-free diet. They all were diagnosed with attention deficit. Every child or their parent reported improvement in all 12 markers of attention deficit hyperactivity syndrome within 6 months. Every child, every marker improved from no close attention to detail, fails to finish their work, interrupts frequently, blurts out answers, all of those common things that attention deficit kids have. Every marker improved in every child within 6 months just by getting wheat out of their diet. Now, if that were a drug, it would be on the front page of every paper in the country.
Mm-hmm.
There's no profit in this. This is a way of eating. But it has dramatic effects if the child has that sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. As far as the gluten-free, what foods are involved? Because I thought it was mainly bread.
Yes, well, primarily it's bread. And on a little segue note there, some people say, but it's in the Bible that bread is the staff of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I say this on stage all the time. I say, with all due respect, and I mean this with great respect,
mm-hmm.
no one on the planet is eating the bread that Jesus Christ ate.
Right.
You find that bread, and fine, you might be able to eat it, but don't use that as an excuse to give a poison to your child. No human can digest this. And if they have the sensitivity, if their immune system is acting up to this, then it's going to cause a problem somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So where is gluten found? Gluten is found as a filler in medications, in sauces, anywhere you use flour, like with gravies,
mm-hmm.
baked goods, sometimes tomato sauces, ketchups, soy sauce. You have to read the labels because they often will say there's wheat or a wheat product in them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're very restricted then on a gluten-free diet.
Actually not. There are thousands of foods that you can eat. You just can't eat wheat.
Oh.
Now, that happens to be a primary food that the majority of us eat many times a day,
mm-hmm.
every day. We have toast for breakfast, a sandwich for lunch, pasta for dinner,
mm-hmm.
toast for breakfast, a sandwich for lunch, lasagna for mm-hmm. dinner, or cookies with dinner, or a piece of pie with dinner. And what you learn is that there are gluten-free pastas. There are gluten-free cookies, gluten-free muffins, and it's a huge business. It's over a $3 billion business last year in terms of gluten-free foods. So people don't have to be in hardship over this. They're mm-hmm. able to have the kinds of foods they like. They just need to talk to a professional that can help them discover how to do this.
Mm-hmm. And you pay extra for the gluten-free foods?
Some of the gluten-free foods probably cost a little more. Some of them cost a little less. I've never done a cost comparison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I think the breads are probably a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But what I recommend to some of our patients is just get a bread maker, and you can buy these bread mixes that are gluten-free. Just mm-hmm. add a little oil and water to them, a little olive oil and some flavorings, and you put it in there, and it bakes bread for you, and it's
mm-hmm.
incredibly delicious.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much cheaper that way.
I've never paid much attention to the gluten-free, but I do eat organic, and
yes.
I know I pay more for that.
Yes.
So I thought yes. maybe the gluten-free was the same.
It may be, but I don't think so. It's not that noticeable, maybe a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But there are tax deductions available for gluten-free foods.
Oh, there are?
If you have a gluten sensitivity.
Oh. Then how long has the brain and neurological symptoms been associated with gluten sensitivity?
Oh, my goodness. The first papers came out in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And at Columbia, in their neurology centers, it's a tertiary center, meaning you go to your doctor and he can't figure out what's wrong. He sends you to a neurologist. He can't quite figure out what's wrong, so he sends you to a research center. That's a tertiary center. And what they find is that 57% of all of the neurological complaints that come into them, 57% of those that are of unexplained origin, they really don't know what they are, they can't
mm-hmm.
get a diagnosis for them, they're gluten sensitivity. When they put them on a gluten-free diet, their symptoms go away.
Mm-hmm.
That the paper started coming out on this in 1992. About how it affects the nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
People that have numbness and tingling, that's one of the most common manifestations in the nervous system if you have a gluten sensitivity. It's very, very common.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go on a gluten-free diet, the numbness and tingling reduces within
mm-hmm.
within 3-4 weeks. It reduces.
Mm-hmm. And how do you find out that you're gluten sensitivity?
That's a really good question, because the tests that have been available for so many years have been notoriously inaccurate. Mm. Many, many people have noticed they do the blood test for celiac disease. It comes back negative, but when they stop eating wheat, they feel better. Mm-hmm. And what's wrong with that picture? And it's the tests. Mm. And I call it the conundrum of gluten sensitivity. And new tests came out about 2 years ago that are much more comprehensive for gluten sensitivity. You don't miss them anymore. Mm-hmm. So people are able to find out now how to do an accurate test for that. And they can find out about that on my website, which is www.thedr.com, thedoctor.com. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of information about those kinds of tests and how accurate they are.
Mm-hmm. Then, is there anything else you would like to tell the listeners about celiac disease or gluten sensitivity before we look at your services and how the listeners can reach you?
Oh, thank you. Yes. I call this a foundational concept. What that means is it's not dependent on what type of symptoms you have. Mm-hmm. For example, if your neighbor had gluten sensitivity and their headaches went away, and you say, well, I don't have headaches, so I don't have a problem with gluten, mm-hmm. that's not correct. That this is a foundational problem. If you pull at a chain, the chain always breaks at the weakest link. It could be at one end, the middle, the other end. It's your heart, your liver, your brain, your kidneys, wherever your weak link is. If you have a gluten sensitivity, that's the pull on the chain.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to manifest wherever your weak link is. For some people, it's MS. For some people, it's liver cancer. For some people, it's attention deficit. For some people, it's muscle pain and fatigue. For some people, it's osteoporosis. There is no system in the body that might not be affected if you have a gluten sensitivity. It just depends on where the weak link is in your chain,
mm-hmm.
as to how it's going to manifest.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the rule of thumb for people is, if you're not getting better with the therapies that you're doing for the symptoms you've got, whatever your symptoms are, you just want to think about this. Well, maybe it's gluten sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a simple blood test that you can do. So it doesn't matter what the symptoms are. What matters is, if you don't feel like $1 million and you're trying to be healthy, this may be the missing link.
Mm-hmm. Great. Then, would you tell us about your services and any products you have and how the listeners can reach you?
Oh, thank you. Well, I don't really have any services to offer. I lecture to doctors and to actually general public groups around the world, and mm-hmm. to celiac support groups and medical conferences and things. And my goal, I'm very altruistic about this, my goal is to get the word out.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a couple of DVDs. Mm-hmm. I've been videoed doing presentations, and there's one for the general public that's about 2.5 hours long with my good friend Susan Vess, who's a chef. And we talk about, what is this problem of gluten, and how do you start turning it around? How do you start eating properly? And then there's a 7-hour DVD, that's my educational program for doctors, and it's more technical. There's over 300 studies that we quote in that 7 hours. Both of those DVDs are available on the website. The website is www.thedr.com, thedoctor.com. Aside from that, I just want people to become aware of this and then go on a hunt to figure out, do I have this? And what do I do about it? And there's some guidelines on my website. We have over 250 doctors now around the country, mm-hmm. who have gone through my certification program and know about this and know how to test for it. And they're listed on the website. There's a map of the U.S. there, and you can see where they're located and mm-hmm. find somebody close to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that person, although I can't promise you how they practice, I can guarantee they've sat in the seminar and they passed the test.
Mm-hmm.
So they know about this. And they should be able to give you some accurate answers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate this very much. As I told you, I did not know a lot about gluten sensitivity. I didn't remember much about celiac disease, because it had been 60 or more years since I had even encountered anyone with celiac disease. So It's been informative to me, and I'm sure it is to the listeners.
I would tell you one more thing, and that is that in the New England Journal of Medicine, they published a paper that said celiac disease is one of the most common lifelong disorders in the U.S. So I say to doctors, if it's one of the most common lifelong disorders in the U.S., how often is it in your practice? And they just sit there kind of starry-eyed, and they realize it's got to be in their practice every day. And it is. It is. It's that frequent. It's there all the time, and we just haven't thought to look for it.
Great. Well, I appreciate this very much, Dr. O'Brien. I thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
It is hard to believe that it has been 38 years since I was faced with the diagnosis of lung cancer at age 42 and beat the odds for survival after being given 6 months to live. As I look back on my life and talked with a friend recently who was helpful during that period, she asked me, "What was the purpose of that experience in your life?" Without hesitation, we both concluded that the experience was given to me so that I might offer encouragement and help to others faced with a diagnosis of lung cancer. Of course, there were other reasons for having the experience, such as improving my lifestyle and moving closer to God, but the main one was to help others. If you know about my background, you know I'm a registered nurse with a doctorate in public health and wellness, so I am well grounded in health, public health, nursing, and holistic health. At the time I was diagnosed, I had completed my doctorate in public health at Johns Hopkins University and was teaching graduate and undergraduate nursing and public health students at a local university. Despite my background, or maybe because of it, I found the diagnosis of 6 months to live and the prospect of being disabled for that period and longer as a result of using conventional treatment, I found this frightening and unacceptable. Thus, I selected alternative holistic treatments to deal with the lung cancer. I not only beat lung cancer, but also reached age 80, free of chronic illnesses and prescribed medications, using all natural interventions, so I know it works. By the way, the average for a 75-year-old is 3 chronic illnesses and 5 prescribed medications, and I am free of all of that. In my book, You Can Beat Lung Cancer, Using Alternative Integrative Interventions, to be on the market next month, I discuss in detail the treatment I used and what I have done since to remain cancer-free and healthy. I also have other natural alternative medical and nutrition interventions in the book by Dr. Bernie Siegel, Dr. Francisco Contreras, Dr. James Forsyth, Dr. Kim Dassel, and Tanya Harder Pierce. In the short time I have today, I want to tell you briefly some of the interventions I used for lung cancer. You will find more information on the book at my website, www.beatlungcancer.net. In July 1974, I had a dream that advised me to get an X-ray, after which a spot was found that had not been on my lung previously. A biopsy confirmed that it was lung cancer, and when I refused chemotherapy and surgery, the doctor told me I would be dead in 6 months. I saw an alternative physician in Northern Virginia who had worked with the National Cancer Institute until the drug companies and FDA closed them down because they were having so much success with Laetril. For me, he prescribed 2,000 milligram daily of Laetril or vitamin B17, a natural substance, and the largest amount are found in apricot kernels. I thus also ate 25 apricot kernels daily. These are specific for cancer because cancer cells have an enzyme that activates cyanide in the Laetril and the kernels, and that destroys the cancer cell, but does not affect normal cells because they do not have this enzyme. In addition, my doctor prescribed pancreatic and digestive enzymes and a variety of supplements, such as huge doses of daily vitamin A and E and vitamin C and B. In addition, I took minerals such as calcium, magnesium, and zinc, and other supplements. The doctor prescribed a diet that consisted of 75% raw fruit and vegetables, with some additional cooked ones, grains, and nuts, but no peanuts that are high in protein, and no protein such as meat, chicken, and dairy. I did take AG Pro tablets and amino acid daily to replace the protein not allowed. Sugar was also not allowed. Because there were no side effects, I continued teaching, writing, carrying out research, and exercising with no difficulty. Because I believe in a holistic approach, I also added the following. For mental aspects, I added meditation, visualization, relaxation, remaining positive, and replacing negative thoughts with positive ones. For spiritual aspects, I maintained my faith in a higher being. I strengthened my patience, faith, and forgiveness. I continued to be of service to others. I obtained emotional support from a friend, church prayer lists, psychic healers, and prayer. I continued this regime for 2 years and overcome the lung cancer, and continuing it with modifications for the next 36 years. And this led to good health, being free of chronic illnesses and prescribed medications. For those of you who have not done some of these interventions, I discuss the how-tos of these interventions in the book. As you may know, lung cancer is the largest killer of all cancers and accounts for more deaths than breast, prostate, and colorectal cancer combined. In general, conventional treatments have failed, whereas there has been major successes with alternative treatment, despite the efforts of federal, medical, and cancer associations to downplay or block these successes from the public. For example, in my book, the two practicing cancer physicians carried out research on their treatments using a 5-year survival in stage 4 lung cancer patients. One had a 39% survival for lung cancer patients compared to 5% by conventional medicine, and the other is having a 7-fold increase in survival. The penalties to these brave physicians for success is discussed in the book, as well as a historical account of how chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation became the treatment of choice, and the efforts to keep these in place despite evidence against their success in treatment. I am Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host, wishing you a great week.